Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, March 11th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today we'll be discussing the Amgen case, which concerns the level of proof required before certification of a class action for securities in a securities fraud case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that, as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from our single expert on today's call of about 20 to 25 minutes, followed by your questions. J.W. Verrett is our expert today. He's an assistant professor at George Mason University Law School. His J.D. and M.A. in public policy from Harvard, came from Harvard Law School and Harvard Kennedy School of Government. While in law school, he was an Olin Fellow in Law and Economics at the Harvard Program on Corporate Governance. He is also a member of the leadership of the Federalist Society's Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group. And with that, Professor Verrett, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Well, thank you, Dean. I really appreciate the opportunity to join you here, and I'm a big fan certainly of these calls. I always find them very concise and informative, and so I'll try to live up to that reputation for these really fun and exciting events. I'm going to talk today about Amgen versus Connecticut, a recent case in securities law decided by the Supreme Court. As I first read this case, I have to say, as this case talks a lot about the level of materiality, that the level and the stage at which materiality must be proven by plaintiffs in order to sustain a class action. The word materiality comes over again and again, and I just couldn't get the song Material Girl by Madonna out of my head, because materiality sort of comes up again and again. So I hope that won't happen to you, although I guess since I've said that now, it will happen to everyone. The basic holding of Amgen versus Connecticut is that proof of materiality is not a prerequisite to certifying a class in a securities class action brought under Rule 10b-5, Section 10 of the Securities Exchange Act, the basic anti-fraud rule, and a rule under which the overwhelming majority of securities class actions are brought. It was a 6-3 decision by the court. The opinion was issued by Justice Ginsburg. Justice Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy filed the dissent. And Justice Alito also filed a concurrence. The case continued a strategy of the defense bar to try to raise the requirements for class certification of securities class actions. It was unsuccessful in the prior case in which it was attempted, and it was unsuccessful here as well. The reason, essentially, for trying to do that is that the overwhelming majority of cases in securities class actions either settle or are dismissed. The overwhelming majority of them. In fact, I think it, on the average, maybe one of 200 or 300 cases will go to trial each year. So the thought being that if you can raise the requirements for class certification, you can obtain a great many more dismissals. And also, one dynamic at play here is the fact, which is argued in the case as a policy consideration, and also I think probably true, that securities class actions, regardless of the underlying merits, have pretty significant nuisance value because of the fact that it requires the deposition of senior executives and the revelation of potentially sensitive corporate information. So let me start with the history of the previous case, Erica P. John Fund versus Halliburton, which held that plaintiffs are not required to prove loss causation in order to certify a class action. Loss causation was one of the six elements of a 10b-5 claim. And the court determined that you don't have to prove that in order to obtain class certification. You eventually will have to prove that at trial, but not in order to obtain class certification. The argument there was that, look, since you have to, in order to certify a class, you have to be able to demonstrate that commonality, that issues common to the class predominate, you'll need to at least argue some of those elements of the 10b-5 claim, which might not necessarily be common to the class. So in the opinion, the Chief Justice wrote the opinion, and he noted that the element of reliance, of the six elements, reliance is the most important of the six in demonstrating the link between the defendant's action and the plaintiff's potential injury. And he distinguished loss causation as an element from reliance as an element in a 10b-5 claim. So he said loss causation and reliance are very different things, and therefore they'll be considered differently. We will require some demonstration of reliance in order to and demonstration that the issues about reliance will be common to the class in order to certify a full class. But we won't require any proof of loss causation in order to certify. And he noted that in demonstrating reliance, plaintiffs can, just as they can at trial, in demonstrating reliance for class certification, they are allowed to rely on the fraud on the market presumption. The fraud on the market presumption being the assumption that the market price of shares incorporates all public info. Thus, an investor relies on public misstatements when he relies on market price. And therefore, you can presume that all of the investors in common relied on the integrity of the market price because you assume that any fraud that was revealed publicly, even if to a small number of people who traded on it, was incorporated into the market price, and therefore the reliance requirement would be a common question subject to the fraud on the market presumption. The reason for this, and that is described in the previous case called Basic versus Levinson, is that otherwise, without that presumption, individual issues would always overcome common ones, and therefore securities class actions would essentially be impossible to certify as a class. Imagine trying to determine the tens of thousands of different plaintiffs all individually relied on a specific misstatement that they probably would have never heard of. So they would have simply more likely relied on the price of the security, the decision to purchase or sell that security. So the assumption of the fraud on the market presumption is underlined by an assumption about market efficiency, and in John P. Erica, the Chief Justice noted that you can always certainly try to rebut that presumption of market efficiency and therefore rebut the fraud on the market presumption, demonstrate a reliance problem, and possibly limit the certification of the full class. So that door was opened in John P. Erica. So fast forward a little bit to Amgen, the case we're talking about today. The attempt here is, rather than trying to say loss causation needs to be demonstrated at class certification, instead, the argument is that materiality is a requirement. Materiality must be proven in order to obtain certification of a class. Justice Ginsburg wrote the opinion here, and she had a couple of basic observations. First, that materiality is an objective standard. Materiality is defined as what would a reasonable investor want to know in the decision to buy or sell securities. That's an objective standard based on the reasonable investor. Therefore, that issue would be based on evidence common to the class. Therefore, the materiality question would, even if the materiality is questionable, would not be based on something that would eliminate class commonality. In other words, maybe the statement is material, maybe it's not. If it's not, it's not, and you lose the entire case. If it is, then it's based on evidence common to the class that doesn't infer any issues with certifying the full class. So that's our first piece of the holding. And secondly, she sort of goes through some of the arguments that Amgen raises. First, she looks to the policy considerations Amgen raises. So Amgen argues, look, securities class actions are prone to abuse. Congress has noted that they are prone to abuse. And Congress has passed laws to try to deal with the fact that securities class actions are prone to abuse because of the high nuisance value of both legitimate and illegitimate claims. Justice Ginsburg first notes that that's fine as a policy argument, but that would that doesn't necessarily mean that materiality it doesn't distinguish materiality from the other six elements of 10b-5. And your argument isn't limited to any of those six elements. In other words, your argument could be used to say that all six elements of the 10b-5 claim would need to be proven prior to certification of the class, but that would actually put the cart literally before the horse and essentially require you to prove the case before you even certify the class to begin the class action. So in addition, she notes that Congress, in passing a law to deal with perceived concerns about securities class actions, also noted that she also noted that a prior draft of that law included the requirement that actual reliance be proven, and getting and a requirement that would get rid of the fraud on the market presumption. And she inferred that the fact that Congress did not pass that version meant that Congress's understanding was that getting rid of the fraud on the market presumption was not vital to limit the problems associated with abuse of securities class actions. So the ultimate holding is that materiality is not a prerequisite to certification of a class action, that the questions about materiality are going to be common to the class because essentially they are based on the reasonable investor objective standard. So Justice Alito filed a concurrence in which he notes that he's willing to revisit the fraud on the market presumption altogether, which would technically be in line with the John P. Erica case, Erica John case that preceded Amgen, because Erica P. John noted that in order to demonstrate reliance, which was an important element to certification of a class, you're allowed to use the fraud on the market presumption. You just have to demonstrate a couple of things, including that the market was efficient. So Justice Alito filed a very brief sort of one-paragraph concurrence, noting that he's willing to revisit the assumption of market efficiency, general market efficiency, that underlies the fraud on the market presumption, with a citation to a piece by Professor Langevoort of Georgetown called Revisiting Fraud on the Market, published in the Wisconsin Law Review. So there's been quite a bit of criticism of the fraud on the market presumption from a number of quarters, from folks that you might sort of associate with sort of free market thought, to folks that you might associate with more sort of pro-regulatory thought. And so I think that the citation to Langevoort and the citation to Macy and Miller in one of the dissents sort of demonstrates that. So, I just want to sort of talk about that final aspect of it. If you read the Thomas dissent, you read the Alito concurrence, and you realize the Thomas dissent, which was joined by Kennedy and Scalia in part, and you also think about the fact that Erica P. John was written by Chief Justice Roberts, you might potentially have who knows, but you might potentially have five votes for concept of getting rid of the fraud on the market presumption, possibly altogether, or possibly making it a sort of case-specific issue, although it's a very general sort of notion, general sort of theoretical notion. The scholarship cited by Langevoort's Stout and Macy and Miller sort of questions the underpinnings of the fraud on the market presumption, questions the assumptions of efficient markets. I just want to point out that though commentary on this case has noted that this is kind of a Pyrrhic victory for plaintiffs, and it might represent a huge victory for defendants, and I think it would if the fraud on the market presumption was eliminated. I think essentially most securities class actions would not be possible if the fraud on the market presumption was eliminated and a multi-billion-dollar industry would sort of disappear. Your perspective on that kind of depends on your perspective of securities class actions. But I want to warn that notion has some potential and rather significant, I think, collateral consequences that could occur, because I think that the assumption of semi-strong market efficiency is an assumption that underlies the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 and all of the rulemaking that the SEC does under it to require mandatory disclosure of specific items. So I think that And the SEC was sort of intended to do two basic things under the 34 Act. One, to promulgate rules that say, hey, companies, you need to disclose specific items in your financial statements, and then enforce fraudulent reporting under those rules using 10b, and essentially go after people who fraudulently either omit important information necessary to make prior disclosures not misleading at the time they were made, or fraudulent disclosures about specific information required. So 10b is intended to work in tandem with the other elements of the 34 Act. And so once I think you question the efficiency assumption underlying 10b, not just in the SEC, but in private litigation, as this case was, right? There's an implied private right of action under 10b. Once you question the efficient capital markets hypothesis that underlies the 34 Act and the relationship between 10b-5 and mandatory disclosure rulemakings, then a collateral consequence, and I think possibly an unintended one by the dissent here, is that the mode of cost-benefit analysis the SEC will be held to perform under the requirement that they consider the impact of rules on items like capital formation and investor protection changes significantly. And at that point, the SEC is no longer held to a materiality requirement, which I think, I would argue, it is held to now. So at that point, the SEC can essentially require non-material items because there's no longer a test of materiality, because you could no longer look to the impact of disclosures of items on the market and the stock price impact of those disclosures as an indicia of materiality, because at that point you are no longer assuming the market is efficient. And so I think that's a consequence that certainly was not thought through. And I hope that the courts will think through, because it changes the impact of the Business Roundtable versus SEC case, which is a, sort of a landmark case that significantly elaborates the cost-benefit analysis requirements that the SEC has held to in disclosure rulemaking. And so that's all I want to say. And I think my summary of the case is probably not all that controversial, although I'm look forward to folks as a securities lawyer who, the SEC often and private plaintiffs go before the Supreme Court. I'm a securities lawyer, not a constitutional lawyer, so it's entirely possible that I've made some glaring error in the constitutional analysis, and I'd love for folks to catch that. Hopefully I've offered a sort of a controversial and provocative point about what would happen if we fully eliminated the efficiency assumption underlying fraud on the market in interpretation 10b-5, and how I think it would change cost-benefit analysis of SEC rules in the mandatory disclosure rulemaking. So with that, I think my 20 minutes are up. I'll turn it over back to Dean.
Thank you very much, Professor. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for Professor Verrett, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, we're talking to Professor J.W. Verrett of George Mason Law School, talking about the Amgen case and securities fraud case. If you have a question for Professor Verrett, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. While we're waiting to see if anyone in the audience has a question, let me make a regular programming announcement. We have three more Teleforum conference calls scheduled for the remainder of the week. At least at this point. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about the Mandiant Report, which is a cybersecurity report with three different experts. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. at this same number. On Wednesday at 3 p.m., we'll be speaking with Peter Wallison about his new book, Bad History, Worse Policy. And then Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about a new white paper that describes the EPA's anticipated attempt to regulate fixed sources in greenhouse gas emissions. That's Friday at 2 p.m. Again, our phone lines are open. If you have a question for Professor Verrett, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see if the audience will weigh in with any questions here, let me ask you a question, Professor, and that is, You mentioned Business Roundtable versus SEC. It has taken a fair share of criticism. Is it good law? Is it going to be challenged? What's the future? I'm asking you to make some predictions here, but what do you see about on that going forward?
Yeah, Dean, I think that everything the SEC does and currently is sort of under the shadow of Business Roundtable versus SEC. It was a really significant extension of a couple of cases that preceded it, which also remanded SEC rules on the basis of insufficient cost-benefit analysis. But this was a big one because it not only looked to permissive rulemakings, but it remanded a rulemaking which the SEC was specifically given authority to do under the Dodd-Frank Act, and it looked to it provided, I think, a lot more sort of elaboration of what the cost-benefit analysis requirements are that the SEC is held to. And it also, I think, frankly, was built on an efficiency assumption, efficient markets assumption, because part of the empirical analysis the court did was to consider, albeit briefly, but to consider stock price event studies of the impact of the proxy access mechanism at issue in the case on firms that had on firms that had essentially considered the impact of proxy contests on firm share price. So there was essentially a market efficiency assumption underlying part of the efficient economic analysis in Business Roundtable. So I think these things tie together, and I think that the securities laws are so interlaced that you can't change. You know, every time you change one aspect of it, there's something over on the other end of mandatory rulemaking that changes. You think a private claim under 10b-5 doctrinal change won't affect, you know, rulemaking by the SEC, but I think in fact it certainly does. I know that Business Roundtable has taken a fair amount of criticism, but frankly, I do think it's good law. The SEC decided not to appeal it to the Supreme Court, and I think with good reason, because the National Securities Markets Improvement Act of 1996 and the Gramm-Leach Biley Act of, I think it was 99 or 2000, that probably 1999, that adopted that efficiency economic analysis requirement, cost-benefit analysis requirement, essentially, was pretty extensive in the legislative history. I think it's pretty clear that it was intended to be a binding constraint on the agency's rulemaking. I think going forward, something that's not black letter doctrine, but I think that is the only correct interpretation of Business Roundtable, is that another constraint on the SEC, and a lot of folks probably won't agree with this in the, you know, legal academy, but I think it is the case that materiality is a constraint on SEC rulemaking. In other words, how can the SEC have the authority to make a mandatory disclosure that issuers would be free to lie about? Because they would be free to lie about it because it would be immaterial and it wouldn't meet the materiality requirement of 10b-5. And to sort of state that another way, how can the SEC require disclosure of an item that investors don't care about and further its mission of investor protection?
Okay, very good. We do have at least a couple callers now who've indicated they have questions. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller question.
Yes. Hi, this is Andy Urko in California, Orange County. And regarding the materiality test, is my reading of this, I don't know if it's the same as yours, but what I'm reading is that the materiality test has been set aside with regard to class certification. However, it still must be proved at time of trial. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. If you want to join the queue, we have one more caller question at this point, and then our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller. Go ahead, caller. You might need to unmute your phone.
I was talking into a mute button. This is not my area of law, but it's my impression that at some point the 10b-5 bar was crippled in its ability to terrorize boards and attorneys and accountants when the board of directors proposed a scheme to defraud the shareholders by saying, well, yeah, you could do that, but you'd get sued and you'd probably lose. And so it may be responsible for things like Enron and all the other corporate scandals we'd have had over the years. And I'm just not clear on the history of that. Could you give us a briefing of what happened to the 10b-5 bar over the past 20 years or so?
Sure. Well, there are a number of interesting things, I think, going on in the 10b-5 bar. The interesting history, I think, starts with the PSLRA, the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995, which was intended, I think, to constrain the bar and to do a couple of things, including providing a safe harbor for forward-looking statements if accompanied by qualifying language, and also, among other things, establishing a lead plaintiff provision to make it easier for large institutional investors to serve as lead plaintiffs rather than merely the first person to file the claim. But in some ways it sort of backfired, because once the institutional investors got into the driver's seat, a much smaller subset, I think, of the plaintiff's bar began to control securities litigation as a result, and as a result in part of the close links between these large institutional investors, which were state pension funds run by state treasurers who run for office and who get the political donations, it turns out, from securities class action attorneys. Now, anytime there's an allegation of pay to play, the assertion is that no, it is the case that that the attorneys are just interested in the financial health of California, and Wisconsin and Ohio, despite the fact that they live in New York or in L.A., but which I think is a little bit questionable. But in any event, one of the effects of the PSLRA was to put lead plaintiffs by putting the lead plaintiff as the largest plaintiff, I think it essentially put a small cadre of the securities class action bar in control of litigation a little bit more. So that's been an interesting effect, I think, of the PSLRA, and it is part of the reason why post PSLRA we didn't really see a drop in class action activity. There have been a lot of cases since then that sort of refine the pleading standards and what is required to be pled under the PSLRA, and now I think that the more recent sort of strain in Erica John and here in Amgen is a notion that even before we get to reviewing the pleading, what needs to be determined to certify the class. There have also been some challenges to the selection of lead plaintiffs and the assertions of conflicts of interest with the lead plaintiffs. I think that might be something that could potentially continue. One of the things that seems to be true, I don't know if it's true in other Supreme Court cases, but it's definitely true in the securities law cases, is that it's one of the things that makes it fun to teach securities law Supreme Court cases is that every major opinion in the last 30 years, there's an opinion before it that sort of predicts that this issue will come up and it'll be important and we might adjudicate it later. So it sort of reads like a serial story, next time. There's a sort of prediction, like a serial, which I think makes it kind of fun. And so the latest prediction for what the next adventure will be will center around the basic assumption of market efficiency. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
What probably has happened, I guess, because of this lead plaintiff thing, is we've gone away from the crowdsourcing toward a more elitist sourcing. of the leadership in the case, which, considering that the board of directors is general, has never been particularly concerned with minority shareholders, it seems to be contrary to the whole purpose of the 10b-5 board.
Yeah, I mean, it was a function of the PSLRA, so I don't know whether it does or not, but now it is part of the function of 10b-5, whether for good or for ill.
Well, once again, our phone lines are open. We have no caller questions at this point. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Last call for questions. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you have a question for our expert today, J.W. Verrett, on the Amgen case or probably any aspect of securities litigation. Well, Professor, it sounds like you've answered all the questions of our audience members. Let me, before we adjourn, give you a chance to wrap up. Take a few minutes to express any final thoughts you have.
Well, I think this is an interesting case. You know, the sort of change in black letter law from this case was actually pretty simple, and could have been done in a page. The real interesting thing is all of the subtext that is going on in this case, and the mode of legislative interpretation of the 34 Act, and what happens with market efficiency, and how the Supreme Court, how the law will evolve with respect to the requirements for class certification. These things are all really interesting. The basic holding is pretty simple, that materiality is not required to be proven in order to certify class, but still required in a trial. But the real interesting thing is all the subtext and the sort of predictive warning that the fraud on the market presumption is on notice, that it is being watched, and it might be eliminated from possibly altogether from 10b-5 doctrine. So we'll have to see what happens. And it'll be interesting to see what the lower courts do with this as well.
Have the lower courts, by and large, followed the Supreme Court? I mean, are there complaints in the securities bar that the lower courts are trying to evade Supreme Court jurisprudence in this particular area of the law? I hear that sometimes with regard to other areas of the law.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on the circuit, but there are times where, for example, here, I think in Amgen, you might say that the lower court's holding here was sort of a way to kind of sneak around the Erica John case. While on the one hand, Erica John said that reliance is important, and you can sort of link materiality to reliance indirectly. On the other hand, it does sort of seem like, look, we've made clear in Erica John, you don't have to prove all the elements of 10b-5 at class certification. Here they just sort of chose a different element than the one at issue in Erica John. So while it wasn't, I wouldn't call it evasive, it probably was strategic.
All right. Well, terrific. This has been very interesting. Let me thank you, Professor, on behalf of the Federal Society for joining our call today. To our audience, let me invite you again to our next Teleforum conference call. That's scheduled for tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number when we'll be discussing cybersecurity. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federal Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.